Hello, hello, hello world. Veronica Barragan here, sitting here in this beautiful environment again with my wonderful sidekick partner in crime here. ¿Cómo está, señor?
I'm great, Mom. How are you?
You know what? I'm doing fantastic, just like every week. You know, yeah. I wonder if there's going to be a week where I'm ever going to be like, you know, it sucked, or today was horrible. You know, that probably would not happen.
Huh? You've never had one of those days?
I've never had one of those days. I'm an indefinite optimist, and apparently, you know, I just don't know what the future is going to hold, but I just think it's going to be fantastic. So do you consider yourself an optimist or a pessimist?
No need to be buffoon. You definitely do have your moments, Mother.
Okay, I'm not a buffoon, number one. And my moments are much more rare now.
Stop now.
Okay, fine. I have my moments too. But today's optimism comes straight from just reading an amazing book this week and being able to indulge in the feeding of the mind. Because it's pretty cool to be able to find masterpieces and literature that revolutionizes the way you think, you know. There's a true sign of wisdom, and what that is knowing that you'll never know it all. Are you okay with that, or do you think that you know it all at your ripe age of 16? Because you act like it sometimes.
All right, Mother. I never act like that, okay?
There's times. You come with your beliefs, and then you try to tell me, and then you forget that, you know, I'm your mom, and then we go at it, and then, you know, sometimes I agree with you, and sometimes I don't.
That's most definitely not true. I never think that.
Did you have a good week? How was your week?
My week was great.
Just great? That's it?
It was phenomenal.
Oh, fantastic. Well, it's always important to make sure that you always look at the good things in your life, because if you start focusing on the negatives, then guess what's going to happen?
Continue to have negative thoughts.
Exactly. So the masterpiece that I took it upon to read this week, thankfully it was recommended to us by Gary Acosta, who is the co-founder of the National Association of Hispanic Real Estate Professionals. And he just joined us on the line, so we're going to get ready to introduce him here in a couple of minutes. It's really exciting to have you here, Gary. How are you?
Hi, Veronica. I'm doing great. Good to hear your voice.
Good to hear yours as well. I have my sidekick here, Mr. Alex Berrigan. Would you like to say hi?
Hello, sir. Nice to talk to you.
Hey, Alex. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Good, good. Good to meet you over the phone.
Right. He's saying, okay, do I need to call him Mr. Acosta, or is it okay if I call him Gary? I said, you know what, you can call him G, you can call him whatever you want. I'm sure he'll be okay with it, right?
Absolutely true.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for being on our show, Gary. You came in right at the right moment. I really appreciate your time. We were just talking about the masterpiece that you actually recommended to us on Facebook, and I saw that you posted that. And I'm all about, you know, reading new books. It's been some time where I found a really good business book. You know, I've read some of the most popular ones, like, you know, Who Moved My Cheese and The Tipping Point and all of those. And so when I saw that you posted that, I thought, well, I've never even heard of Peter Thiel. And I read just a brief summary of it, and I thought, well, this sounds really interesting. And once I downloaded it and I started listening to the audiobook, I just really could not put it down. And I sent you a message and I said, thank you so much, because this is something that really, like, it simplifies really what's been going through my mind and figuring out what the future really holds for us and how we can create it to be better. So I want to first, before we start getting into the actual book, and we have lots of questions for you, Alexander and I, because you have an awesome background. So before we actually start getting into it, would love for you to introduce yourself and kind of tell us a little about what you do, and then we're going to get into some of the things that you've learned from this book, and maybe we can compare notes. Does that sound fair?
Sure. So, I grew up in Southern California, went to college down here, and sort of stumbled into the mortgage banking space when I was in my mid-20s. When I started working for a community bank in Mission Viejo called Mission Viejo National Bank. And it was really there that I learned the mortgage business and learned to like it. And a couple years later, I was back down in San Diego I started working for a mortgage broker. I thought it was just something I was going to do part-time. And then, once again, I really got interested in the business. I started my own mortgage brokerage when I was 26 years old, and I partnered with who would eventually be my wife, Kathleen. And so we started our own company at a pretty young age, and probably 5 years later had graduated from being a mortgage broker to a mortgage banker, which, as you know, is a company that actually funds its loans versus a company that just arranges or processes loans. So that was a big step for us. And, again, really sort of learned the business, started to grow that for a little while. But at around that time, I met a gentleman by the name of Ernie Reyes, who was a real estate broker down here in San Diego, and became really good friends with him. We used to do business together, and Ernie was kind of a passionate guy. He had a political background. He was a real estate broker, but he used to work for a congressman up in Northern California. Was very involved in the political process and really educated me on all of that. And somehow, some way, during the course of a lot of conversations, lots of cup of coffee, and a number of Mexican breakfasts that we shared together, came to the decision that we should start something, that we should start an organization that helped to organize the Hispanic real estate space. You know, at the time, you know, there was already the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. There was the Hispanic Bar Association. There was the Hispanic Nurses Association and professional engineers. So it was surprising to us, quite frankly, that there was no Hispanic real estate organization, because there was probably as many Hispanics employed in the real estate industry as there was in any other profession, but it didn't exist. So we took the leap of faith and we started the organization, and you know, it took a lot of nerve to do that, considering that we didn't really know anybody outside of San Diego. But we got some really great help from a lot of great people, and one of those people was Henry Cisneros, who we had met just by writing to him, and he wrote back, and he provided us with great guidance. Henry was the former HUD secretary under President Clinton, and at the time was the president of Univision in L.A., so he was kind of a big shot. And so for him to, you know, respond to us and agree to provide us with guidance was really a big break for us. And, you know, once NARF started, it really became more than just a sideline thing for me. It became a passion project. I sort of poured my sort of heart, soul, and time into it, and it was a really, really tremendous experience. So NARF is now a 15-year-old organization. We have about 20,000 members across the country. We have 35 local chapters, and it's really become a really terrific movement within the real estate space, where Hispanics get together and they share best practices. They, you know, develop deeper relationships, and hopefully over time help each other develop even more success in the real estate space. Home ownership is really central to Latinos in general. It's a great goal and aspiration, and we think it does a lot of great things for the quality of life. So it combines a lot of the things that we're passionate about, and it's now, you know, sort of my full-time focus. So NARF is present in the political process. It's present within major corporations, and it's present at the local level as well. So it's terrific.
So what a perfect, more perfect person. My son is sitting here saying, wow, that's pretty awesome. I think when you actually hear it versus seeing it on paper, what a more perfect person to talk about this particular subject, which is this book that you recommended to us. How did this, I want to ask you first, how did this book come into your hands? And then, if you don't mind, I want to go into different areas, because I think that based on your experience and success, we can really kind of look at the book in different sections and see how you've applied it to your success, as well as also what is your vision for the future? Because this book really puts out a huge call to action as to people, as to really the population to start thinking about creating the future versus waiting around to see, just having optimism that we'll have a better future just because we think that way. And so one of the first things that you said, especially, and I remember seeing that on Facebook, was about competition. One of the quotes that Peter Thiel, and he was a PayPal co-founder. He's 47
right
now, and he's worth He's worth about $2.2 billion right now. He's a Stanford graduate. He was an early Facebook investor. And I loved what he said in the book where he says the future should not be just for Stanford students. So when I started reading the manuscript, I thought, wow, this is literally me sitting in a Stanford class listening to him lecture. You know, for all of us that think we didn't go to Harvard or Stanford or Yale, I mean, really, if you take what this book tells you, it's not a manual. It's more like a thinking process to get you to really think about what impact you can make to the future. And one of those things that he says is all failed companies are the same. They fail to escape competition. And you said that also on your Facebook post, that was one of the things that stuck with you the most. Can you tell me how that applies to your current business as well as what do you think of that whole quote in general?
So I'll say this. So, you know, you first said, you know, how did you kind of stumble on the book? And so like you, I like to read business books. You know, some of them I think have great content. A lot of them are repetitive in my view. So they kind of point to the same things, you know, discipline, resilience, you know, thinking outside of the box. I mean, they say a lot of the same things in a lot of different ways. I didn't really know who Peter Thiel was. I stumbled on a magazine article about him, and I was interested in, you know, a lot of the stuff he says is really kind of eye-catching. So he talks about things in a way that really is, I think, challenges conventional wisdom. And he talks about our educational system in the same way, right, as it being, you know, is it really the best way to invest your money and invest your time given our system today? People don't really ever say something like that. So he kind of caught my eye as being a sort of contrarian, somebody who challenges conventional ways of thinking. So then when I heard about his book coming out, his name sort of rang true. I remembered it. And so I looked into it. And, you know, the first kind of quote was the one that you referred to, which is he says, competition is for losers. And I thought, all right, well, that's not something you hear every day. that's worth a second look. And so I would say that for me, it played some sort of special application because I've been a mortgage banker. You know, I've been in the real estate space. I've done a lot of the things that, you know, are common or typical, and there's nothing wrong with that. But, you know, I started NARP because I wanted to pursue something that was groundbreaking, right? It's one thing to have a business. It's one thing to have a job and to be successful at that. It's a different kind of fulfillment you get when you're doing something that's never been done before. And so I loved spending my time at NARP because I felt that we were doing things that were creative and innovative and having a really profound impact on people's lives, right? So, I mean, that's rewarding. It's great. And so once you kind of get on that track, you don't want to leave that track. You want to continue to do things that inspire you in that way. So when I started to read the book, and I read excerpts of it first before I actually read the book, it played into that a lot because it really encouraged you to go out and really push the envelope and to create and to innovate. He really says that competition, you know, is something that is viewed as a virtue in our economy and in our society, that it's good, it's for the greater good. There's lots of competition. And because the theory behind that, Veronica, is that, you know, if two companies are competing for a customer, that they're going to, you know, make sure that their services or their product is really good, and they're going to make sure that their pricing is pretty competitive, because if it's not, the competition is going to get that business from them. So it's logical to think that competition is good in that regard. He goes on to say, let me tell you why it's not good. And he says that at the end of the day, competition is going to diminish profits down to close to nothing, if not nothing at all. And that companies who are involved in competitive businesses end up having to squeeze their employees really tightly. They end up having to cut costs completely or down to a nub. And at the end of the day, it's not a place that people enjoy working necessarily. It's not a business that people are fulfilled in terms of pursuing. And those businesses have no time to think about anything other than beating the competition. Mm-hmm. So they can't think about things like what's in the greater good of the country or what's in the greater good of society or mankind or any of those things. And he points to other companies that who have taken more innovative approaches, like Google, for example. He uses them as an example. They've gotten so much better at their business, search. It's such an innovative company. They're also a company, because they're sort of a monopoly, that enjoy profits, and that gives them the liberty to focus on other things, like improving the quality of life here in this country, being concerned about the environment, and those types of things. So it really was a different way of thinking, and one that appealed to me a great deal.
Yeah.
You mentioned monopolies. It really, like, surprised me in the book how it said, I always thought of, like, monopolies to be, like, something of a bad thing, like Rockefellers or Walmart or, like, stuff like that. But then it says how monopolies could lead to innovation, because instead of doing, continue to do the same old things, it to lead to something new. And that was very surprising to me.
I think that's right. So most monopolies are created through some form of corruption. So if you're in a country, you know, in Latin America or in the Eastern Bloc of Europe, this is how a monopoly is usually a government, allowing one particular company to distribute all of the natural gas, for example, in that country. And so, of course, if you're the only one that's allowed to distribute natural gas in your country, or, you know, soft drinks for that matter, because the government is,
right,
you know, deems you to be the only person who can do that, you have a monopoly. And because you have that monopoly that's been granted to you by the government, you don't have any incentive to provide great service or a great price to the consumer. So that's why our perception of monopoly is it's a bad thing. What he's saying is there's such a thing called a creative monopoly. A creative monopoly is a company that is so good at what they do, either because they developed some terrific technology, or they've had, they've created a huge network, or they've developed just a pristine brand in the marketplace that is so superior to the competition, they really have no practical competition. And that type of monopoly, he thinks, has a lot of benefits to our society. Because to your point, when you're just obsessed with competition, you don't have the time nor the resources to invest in anything else other than beating the competition. Whereas creative monopolies such as, Google, such as, maybe a Facebook, Microsoft for a while, these are companies that developed, a great deal of profits and therefore had the resources to invest in new technology, new innovations, and to be cognizant of the world in general. And so it was a different way of thinking altogether.
Yeah, and I think in general it's a new wave. I mean, my son, he's 16, and these thoughts to him are like common sense. Like, you know, it's more like why do we have to, Darwin, survival of the fittest, the only thing he's really like quoted for. You know, it's like a new generational thing where the past hasn't worked any longer, and so we can't really base our future on that any longer. And so that's why it's so important to be able to create companies like this that do offer amazing services, that don't have the competition because they're so amazing, but that are focused on putting back, whether it is to, like you said, into the world or to the employees or to the people that actually make that company run. So I was under the misconception as well as to what a monopoly was. And then I really kind of correlated competition a lot with capitalism, which he explains that they're the complete opposite, because capitalization is all about accumulating capital versus competition. It runs on the premises of just borderline like socialism.
Yep.
And so that's
again,
that's a big
big different way of thinking. Yeah, and you look at, he refers to his colleagues from PayPal as the PayPal Mafia. And you've got Elon Musk, who were part of that. And so your son is growing up in an environment where these are the business icons, the Elon Musk, the Peter Thiel's, people like the gentleman that bought it, Facebook, Zuckerberg, and so forth,
yeah.
Right? And so these guys didn't pursue, let me see if I can figure out how to get into a business that exists and do it faster and cheaper than somebody else. Elon Musk said, I'm going to get into the car business, but I'm going to create a whole different kind of car, a car that is positive to the environment, a car that is more cost efficient, and a car whose performance is equal or better than the cars that are on the road today. That's the way he goes about it. And the book talks about the lack of that mindset over the last 20, 30 years. The globalization, the discussion about globalization, where it's just businesses are predicated on just taking something that is already proven to work as a model and just expanding its distribution, scaling it to new markets as being one form of business, one that he does not think highly of. He thinks, you know, there's no innovation in that. People should be more compelled and focused on creating new solutions that are quantum leaps in terms of their improvement in the way they service people and the way they improve the quality of life.
Yeah, I love the way he talks about the 10X effect, you know, as you're thinking about what it is that you're going to be creating. Again, not just copying and redoing and then trying to take down your competitor, but about really sitting down and thinking whether you're the business or whatever your startup is, it really offers at least 10 times more of the value of whatever your closest competitor could ever be. And a lot of us, you know, when we think about
it,
go ahead.
No, that's absolutely right. Taking quantum leaps, yeah.
Quantum leaps, yeah. But also, which is really interesting, and he ends it with this, is that the paradox is that, you know, today's entrepreneur is actually being forced to really think smaller, to really focus on a market, dominate it, and then deliberately expand on it versus, hey, let me just capture everything that I can and dominate the world. Is that something
that, I love that part. You know, that, again, was different, right? So he's talking and referring to companies that are changing the world. But he says most, if not all of those companies, didn't focus on changing the world out of the gate. They focused on developing a solution that was 10 times better than anything else in the market, but dominating a smaller market first, really proving the concept, honing the whole process and your product down to a T, and then taking it, you know, to a broader marketplace. Facebook starting off as just a social networking site in Harvard alone, and then trying to capture all other colleges, and going from colleges to the, you know, the whole world. I thought that was a really fascinating way to look at it as well.
Yeah, and that's what's cool about the book, that it gives so many examples of other companies, successful companies that have done that. For example, PayPal. You know, PayPal also only started with the eBay, and then the eBay people only started with the Beanie Babies, the ones that people that wanted to sell the Beanie Babies. They didn't go and try to capture the whole entire world. Amazon started with the books, and then they could have gotten more readers, but instead they ended up getting more more products, right? And now
that's
right. The online store. So what it really takes is what he says, which is hard, is self-discipline to not get what looks shiny distract you, and to instead become a visionary and a founder that has a long-term vision and that can be self-disciplined to not be tempted. Has that been at all difficult for you at all in your shoes with NARUP especially?
So I think that's a really great thing. So when I started to, you know, when I find a business book that I really like, of course, like a lot of people, you try to apply it to the business that you're in, right? So how can I take some of the concepts or disciplines or ideas and apply them to my business? And so so I looked at what we're doing with NARUP, and I took a step back and said, you know, here's some things that I think align. First of all, NARUP is, I think, an innovative organization. Although it's a trade association, it is like any other business in the sense that we have a lot of the same objectives and a lot of the same challenges that businesses have to deal with. We're an entity that does that. We're a corporation. So what are the things that are applicable? So another thing was, if NARAP, so let's take a step back. So we look at the mission statement of NARAP, and that is to facilitate sustainable Hispanic home ownership, right? So why is that important? Why is that a worthy cause? Well, okay, so if you own your own home, we think that that creates a more stable environment. It's a great vehicle to create wealth over time. All those things add up, in my view, to a better quality of life for the Hispanic community. So our feeling is, as an organization, if people have the opportunity, people who have the means and the desire to participate in home ownership do so, then their quality of life can be better, right? That's basically it in a nutshell.
Right.
So so I would say go even further and say, okay, so what can NARAP become in 10 years, right? So I would say NARAP needs to continue to do what it does to be really an extraordinary organization in serving the Hispanic real estate space, right? But 10 years from now, it could be beyond that. It could be, home ownership is one vehicle that improves the quality of life for Hispanics. But one of the other areas that Hispanics need to improve on is just our ability to acquire and accumulate wealth. So if we want our children to be educated, we want our families to have a better quality of life, we want Hispanics to be able to design the lifestyle that they want to pursue, wealth is an essential component of that. So it's sort of a broader sort of effort to get to the same goal, which is improving quality of life, right? So I think we need to continue what we're doing to dominate the Hispanic real estate market space with our eyes on maybe going even beyond that over time.
So when you look for more into the future, that means you're adding value to your organization?
That's the only way the organization thrives, is that if we are adding value to the participants, that means our members, our sponsors, our employees, all of them are being enriched by their participation in the organization. So we take what we learn from the space that we're in, and we try to apply that to other segments of the economy and the population in general as we get better at what we do.
Fantastic. Yeah, and that's exactly it. I mean, when he spoke about, and he really did he did talk about the seven questions that a business must answer to be able to, see whether they're going to be actually successful. They're going to be, they're going to go from zero to one versus, be another statistic. And although he says, not to check it off, this is not a check-off list, because I don't know what you think, but for me it was more like a mental exercise. It was not necessarily like a manual. You know how we get some of those business books that say, here's what you do first, second, third, and fourth? This was more of a, hey, let me really sit down and think about all of this. And he puts out the seven questions that you must answer, and I'm not going to read all of them, but they're very important. When we look at this type of information, though, there's something else that I feel the book is even saying much more an important tone, which is the fact is that there are a lot of secrets. He talks about the secrets, and he says that they have not even been discovered. And it reminded me of that when you said that right now about, providing value and how the organization will evolve. There's so many secrets that are not discovered yet and so many different sectors, education, technology, in so many different ways. And we're so conditioned, especially here in America, to just kind of not even look for them anymore. And if anything, I think what this book really did for me was to really just kind of sit back and think and just say, hey, what needs to still be discovered? And I can see that takes a lot of creativity, but it takes a lot of perseverance. It sounds like for you for 12 years, is that something that you had to take into consideration? Like, where did you find the secret of that the organization will need it? Because it is.
Well, I think for me it was more intuitive, right? So I felt that my own experience as a real estate or a mortgage for me, entrepreneur, it was clear to me that something like this was lacking. Especially when I talk about I made the graduation from being a mortgage broker to a mortgage banker. So I was a young entrepreneur that wanted to build a bigger business, right? And at some point I kind of reached a glass ceiling where I thought, I don't know what to do next. I don't know who to call. I don't know what resources I need to prepare myself and position myself for the next level of my business. Gee, if I had an uncle that had owned a community bank, I would call him. Or if I had a contact at, you know, Freddie Mac or Fannie Mae, I would call one of them and say, okay, here I am. Here's what I want to go. Where do I? But I didn't have any of those relationships. I didn't have anybody like that who was accessible to me. And I thought, that's one of the problems. One of the problems that needs to be fixed is we need to create a platform where people like myself, who have aspirations to build a bigger business, who want to make good decisions around building those businesses, have a resource to be able to do that. And so you look, Veronica, you look at the NAREP network across the country today, and you'd say any one of them is one or two phone calls away from just about anybody you can think of in this industry, right? Whether it's a senior executive over at Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac, or the secretary of HUD, or the FHA commissioner, or you know, anybody in between, the CEO of Section 21 Corporate, Realogy, a chapter president could call me up and say, hey, is there any way we can get this kind of information from these people? And we can make that happen today. Our members have that access today. Some of them use it, some of them don't use it. But the fact is that access didn't exist 15 years ago. So that was my motivation. That's why I intuitively knew that something like this was needed. It felt like there were a lot of other people who would be in the same boat, but that was really just a guess from my part.
Yeah, and I guess it just takes, it really depends on the view that we take on life. The book talked about the indefinite optimism, Do you remember that?
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So I never classified myself as an indefinite optimism, but now that I read what it meant, I guess I was that person. Indefinite optimism meaning that, yeah, you feel the future is going to be better, but you don't know how it's going to happen necessarily. And I guess what he says is that most Americans really live that way. And then he talked about, you know, definite optimism, where, you know, you have the plans to make the future better. Then there's indefinite pessimism, or you're like a self-fulfilling prophecy. Here it comes. I mean, that's what you're gonna, what's gonna happen. And also definite optimism. Definite optimism was, definite pessimism was a self-fulfilling prophecy, and definite optimism is really where it's at, where you have a plan in action, and then you actually take the steps to actually make your future be different. And I mean, that's what happens when you're dealing with a startup. You're actually putting the puzzle pieces together to actually make something happen. You know, what do you consider yourself now? Are you part, I mean, do you agree with him? Do you think that America is definitely more of a definite indefinite optimism type viewpoint, or is this something that you think that's shifting and that more people are actually taking notice of?
I do think that, you know, that is, like I said, I have never heard anybody make those types of generalizations the way he did about, you know, Americans versus other parts of the world. But it made pretty good sense to me. So I do think that that is something that's true. I think it is changing. And, you know, part of that is not necessarily a positive thing, but it was a compelling and challenging way to sort of, you know, categorize a certain mindset. He broke it into those four quadrants, right? You know, I thought that was a really interesting part of the book as well, for sure.
Yeah, it's almost like, you know, like he says, we can't just keep applying the Darwin theory of evolution where, you know, evolution happens magically almost, where, you know, there's no plan in it. There is just progress. And that's what it seemed like the underlining message was throughout the book. It's kind of like, hey, get yourself together. There's a lot of stuff to be created, what are you waiting for? Because otherwise, our future is very uncertain. It was almost scary. I don't know about you.
Yeah, he basically says that, and he uses basically a mathematical analysis, basically saying that without innovation, that we're basically going to consume the earth.
Are you there, Gary?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Can you hear me?
Did we lose you?
Hello?
So we may have lost him right now. So
I can hear you.
Definitely, it has to do with the fact that, you know, we can't just be sitting around to...
Hello?
Hey there, Gary.
I'm here.
We lost you.
Can you hear me?
Go for it. What were you saying? Yeah, we can hear you now.
Yeah, I believe it or not, I could hear you the whole time, but you just stopped being able to hear me. So
weird. All right.
So, anyways.
You were talking about
saying that. Yeah, the book makes the case that innovation isn't just, I think, to your point, something that can improve things. That it is essential. That if we don't innovate, if we don't create, greater efficiency, then we're essentially going to consume the planet. He says that, if you look at what the United States kind of consumes in the way of natural resources in on a per capita basis, and you go and you apply that to China or India or any of these other sort of emerging countries with huge populations, will run out of natural resources, in a matter of a short period of time. So globalization, he thinks, is actually dangerous in that sense, is that we want to go apply the quality and standard of life that Americans have to some of these other countries. And it sounds great, but if we don't innovate at the same time, then we are setting ourselves up for disaster. So he takes on some big concepts. I mean, he doesn't make the case just from a business standpoint, hey, if you want to build a great business, this is the way to do it. He talks about how this is an imperative from a global standpoint.
From your perspective in, like, policy change and politics, do you believe that viewpoint changing?
In D.C.?
Do I believe what? I'm sorry.
That process is changing, that we're stopping from overindulging in Washington, D.C., and now we're starting to make a difference, and we see that what we've been doing.
I would say that I don't really see that happening yet. I still think that, the problem with our political system is that it is set up to reward short-term scenarios, and there are no mechanisms that reward long-term scenarios. In other words, if a politician says, hey, here's what we need to do to make sure that our country is in a better position in 25 years, we need to be, we need to conserve our natural resources, we need to invest more in our infrastructure in the future, and so forth, that politician is going to lose in a election to a politician that says, who basically is saying, hey, if you vote for me, you're going to get this today, and at the expense sometimes of what's best for the country or the world in the long run. So I don't feel like our system right now is addressing these issues in a positive way yet.
But yet it does seem like there are definitely coming more to light due to the internet and social networking and, all the things that are not working, all the injustices. One of the things he says is that if there's no longer any secrets, then we would have no injustices left in this world. So obviously they're out there, and there's things that we can work on to make this a better future, right?
That's absolutely true. That's absolutely true. And, he talks about those secrets as not just being, technology secrets, but what he calls truths, right?
Yeah, he talked about even the biotech industry, how You know, they're being funded billions of dollars, yet the progress is so stagnant. It's like we're still at the same place. I mean, it was kind of shocking when you said that, you know, if we really look around us, this world actually looks pretty old, you know, compared to what we thought it would look by this year. You know, the people in the 70s thought, you know, by this year we'd be doing a lot more things than what we're doing. So what is
cars.
It? Yeah, exactly. I'm still waiting for my flying car, and it's not here. So what is it? Is it the fact that that you think it has to do with human conditioning and just kind of being complacent and letting other people resolve our issues, or is it just because we lost hope? I mean, what is it?
So I don't think it's that we lost hope. I do think that, you know, and he talks about the fact that we landed on the moon in like 1968, right? So like in 50 yeah. years, or 69, whatever it was, that in 50 years we would be, you know, we'd have, you know, condos on the moon by now. And that we'd figure out, you know, 10 different solutions around our energy situation and so forth. And somehow that all didn't come to pass. Right. But I don't think that that means that it's not going to. I think that there was just the incentives that we had drove innovation in a different direction. Right. Globalization was an easier path to pursue to wealth. And so people focused on that more than innovating, which is tougher. But, mm-hmm. you know, you look at guys like Elon Musk, you look at people who are, you know, out there and emerging in terms of developing not just, you know, new information technology, but technology that actually is, you know, I think supportive of the promise that was, you know, sort of assumed to be the case 50 years ago. So I think we're going to get back on the right track. I'm not that pessimistic, but I don't think it's going to happen on its own. It's going to require policy. It's going to require education. And I think books like this really help stimulate that.
Yeah, I mean, there's even, I love the way he spoke about, you know, the fear of people being afraid that computers will overtake us even at one point. And I saw now because of the book why people would think that way, but now I can also see that, you know, the way he sees it, and he's somebody obviously very involved in technology with all the things he did, especially with PayPal. But really how they're just, you know, they're an attribute. They're supposed to help us, not necessarily, like, take us down. And so I think the more we let go of that fear factor and the more we can really use technology to help us, you know, create that better future versus being afraid that, you know, they're going to take over us.
Right. Exactly.
And, I mean, the stuff that he did with the PayPal and, you know, he was losing more money at the beginning because they were hacking into the accounts and taking all his money. And, you know, what he did to prevent all that now is being used by government agencies. So I think, if anything, this book really just showed, wow, you've got to have a much bigger mindset. It's not just about creating that next dollar. It's about creating a long-term sustainable business. Which is a question that I have for you, which is what he says is founders are very, very important, obviously, to our organization. I had the privilege of knowing your co-founder as well, Ernie Reyes, an excellent man of all, very wise and just completely humble, same as you. How do you position yourself to still be that innovative founder and not get stuck in the old ways? And how do you run your mafia? How do you run your team?
Well, I mean, thank you for all of that. And as you know, we lost Ernie last year, and so that was you know, that was difficult for all of us. He was such a great mentor to me, and Ernie was you know, a very different individual, very, very optimistic, really believed in, you know, the human spirit for sure. So not having him is definitely created sort of a gap out there for me and for a lot of us. You know, I mean, that's a great question. You know, I think that, you know, I've always been somewhat sort of conditioned to try to innovate. I've always, you know, been attracted to that. It's always much more rewarding to me to develop something that is unique and creative. So I think there are other people out there like that. I think we get in an environment where we become cynical sometimes, and we think that we don't have the ability to make change, and that, you know, no one person can actually do anything that's going to change things in any significant or measurable way. I'm lucky because I've had the opportunity to do something that I've seen actually have an impact on people's lives. I've seen the way it's trying to change the course of the way people think. So that gives me all the confidence and all the inspiration that I need to continue down that path.
Oh, my God, that's awesome. So passion and mission is the absolute must. It's not about, like you said, when somebody builds a monopoly, it's not about making that money. It's about making an impact and making the world different. And I think especially when you're a startup or if you're a small business, we forget about all of that. You know, we start and we don't think about 20 years from now, what really am I making a difference? And also we do things that perhaps are not really what we're passionate about. And that comes with, you know, like we mentioned, the school system, you know, getting them to be well-rounded students that know a little bit about everything instead of focusing on one amazing thing and that they could dominate. And that's, those are shifts, you know, even myself as a parent, I'm seeing that now to be able to trust and say, hey, I trust in you. Let your creative spirit take you where it needs to go. Or do you disagree
with
that?
Totally.
You have an awesome, your son is totally into arts as well, isn't he?
Yeah. So, yeah, my son is just turned 15 years old, and he's got a burgeoning acting career. He's a great singer. But he's also a great basketball player and a good student, so he's pretty well-rounded. And so we just, encourage him to do things that he loves and is passionate about. And we're just lucky that he, he's a really terrific kid. He likes that stuff. We'll see where it leads him, but for now, he's enjoying himself.
Definitely, and I think that's where this book becomes a game changer, to be able to think a little differently. Not to say, I mean, I think college and university is absolutely important. You're getting this kind of information on your lectures, and then also the networking and the people. I mean, all these people knew each other from college, and they just started businesses from there. So it's so important. And how much more important could this be if this book got into the hands of like every 10-year-old or 12-year-old, especially Latino 10 and 15-year-olds? They could read this and say, hey, by the way, you are a beacon of light for the future. Do you realize that because of who you already, you're already here, that you have the opportunity to really mold what's to come? I mean, that's a message that's worth enough to just read this book, don't you think?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I
think so what was your biggest... So what was your biggest takeaway from this book, if I could ask you that?
So what I took away from it is where I focus. Where I focus the things that I do. Let's use Nara for an example. So when he broke down really the basic elements of a monopoly, right? Let's just call it the great organization. So, you know, element number one is that it has either technology or, when he refers to technology, he doesn't necessarily mean information technology or computers. He's talking about either technology in that context or just a system or a process is a
right.
new technology, essentially. So, do you have something that's proprietary in nature? Do you have something that's proprietary in nature and that is 10 times better, as he puts it, than what is available out there in the marketplace? So I look at my business and I say, do we have anything like that? And I would say probably not at this point. I don't think that we do. But we need to continue to look at ways that we interface with our constituency. So I look at NARA, for example, and I say, why has NARA been successful when other efforts to organize Hispanics in business or in real estate have not succeeded? And I said, okay, so let's really kind of evaluate that. And so I figured that if I could sum that up in a sentence or two, that is, we found a way to balance the emotional connection that people have to their culture, with the business connection that really drives Hispanics in this country, right? We're here for economic opportunity. So to be able to combine those two things and do it in the appropriate balance is our secret sauce, our secret technology, so to speak. So understanding that, being cognizant of that, and being even better at that is one of the takeaways and focuses that we want to do. Then we look at other things, such as it talks about network effects. It says, look at Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
There's other companies that have probably developed better technology than Facebook today for social networking. But Facebook already has 1 billion people who use their system. So the likelihood that those 1 billion people are all going to move at one time to another platform, regardless of how good it is pretty unlikely, right? So they have a networking advantage.
Right.
So NARAP has a networking advantage, right? We have a chapter network, and we have individual members, and they've developed relationships with each other, and they've become familiar with the brand and so forth. So how do we sort of emphasize our networking effect and make sure that the organization continues to develop that network and that we know how to use that network well, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, and then the other two pieces that they refer to is let's see, what are the other pieces?
The durability and the...
Economies of scale. So economies of scale is what you're doing scalable and making sure that it always does, and branding. Those are like the four pieces of a monopoly, right? So and so we need to be better at disseminating our brand, making sure that people, when they see our brand, are identify things that are positive and that are tangible. So anyways, to kind of take it away, I looked at the four things that make up a monopoly, I am continuing to evaluate them based on what we're producing in the marketplace and focusing on the areas where we can continue to be even better and more dynamic in terms of what we do. So the long
answer.
And
that's pretty awesome. No, that's awesome because you're able to – what's cool is that you're able to implement the teachings of this book to something that you've already created, as well as – and that's even if you're like – I believe like if you're in a corporation, you know, if you really take these fundamentals and you're working for someone else, and maybe it's not a startup, but how do you get this corporation to move forward, right? Or if you're an entrepreneur and you – want to start something new, you know, ask yourself the questions that are here in this book before you really are able to move forward and say, hey, this is not going to sink. You know what I mean?
Right. Right.
And it's not, that's what I loved about this is that he says it's not like there is no manual out there for success on an entrepreneur, but there's certain things that you're able to notice. And you mentioned all of them, the engineering question, the timing question, which is really important, you know, is this my time? Is this the time to do it? Monopolies, is truly a monopoly that is different and that provides 10 times value? My distribution, he talked about that a lot, which we haven't even had time to get into. He talks about advertising and marketing, but do you have a strong distribution plan? Because guess what? Although it should sell, you know, everyone says your product should sell itself, you know, is there a plan to actually execute to get it out there? And then, number seven, which was the secret. You know, what secret? He actually tells you. Ask yourself what secrets is nature not telling me, and what secrets are people not telling me. So you can kind of really start to think about those things to figure out exactly what it is that your value proposition is. So it really encompasses everything that it takes past successful, very successful companies. We're not talking about, you know, a couple million here. We're talking about billion-dollar companies that he references throughout the book, which I love. And it almost makes it seem like it's not that hard. It almost makes it seem like you've got to just be able to really, like you said, you said the word intuition earlier, to be able to tap into your intuition to see that there is a problem, and I love what he says. He says, look at something that most people are not even willing to solve, right? And look at that, and then just take it, and then ask yourself these seven questions if you think you have a solution. And then from there, you know, just be self-disciplined. Follow what I've been telling you about growing gradually and you know, having a tight-knit market that you can actually dominate. and then the rest will fall into place. Do you think that he's maybe this book is also not telling us one secret, that we're maybe one step behind of some, like, the next generation, or do you think this is it?
First of all, I think that secret whole, you know, idea is central to the book. I agree with that. I mean, he even starts off the book by talking about questions that he asked during a job interview, right? So can you name one thing that you believe in that most people do not, right, essentially? And that's where he's kind of driving at those sort of embedded truths that are out there, those secrets that are out there. And those secrets, you know, can, you know, be the source of great opportunity and great, you know, businesses, quite frankly. So to answer your question is, do I think that there that he's correct in assuming that there's other secrets out there? What was your question exactly?
Yeah, I mean, do you believe in that? Do you feel that there's still a ton of secrets out there that really they're still waiting to be discovered, and that, you know, that we can still tap into, even within your organization?
So I would say that there are many more secrets out there that are yet to be discovered than already have been discovered. Because he talks about, you know, how people are depressed today, right? Because
yes,
there is less not creativity, but that the world has basically been discovered, and that there is no longer any real sort of energy being invested,
like whimsical.
In, yeah. So, but I think that this is a plateau in history myself, that there was this great period of time where there was all these discoveries and all this, innovation. And then, you know, it sort of plateaued for a period of time, but I think we're right on the cusp on a new wave of innovation and discovery. That's my opinion. Maybe it's just because I'm
That's
American.
That's so awesome. No, that's awesome. We need that. We need definite optimism, not indefinite, that's for sure. If anything, that's probably my biggest takeaway. Just make sure, you know, as much as you want to plan and into the future, it's more of a vision. It's not necessarily, you know, being so tied down, because, you know, the future does evolve and you go with it, and you just make, like you said, you add value. This has been a really awesome book. I can't tell you enough, and more excited I am that I was able to share it with my son, who read it, and my husband, and my 10-year-old started, but he's like, "Mom, what? I want to go dance," and I'm like, "Okay, well, I'm not gonna make you listen to it as well," but I think it's just awesome to be able to have access to this type of information and to be able to get your mind going on what could possibly be. I think it really teaches you to just think so much bigger than you've been thinking, and to think of creating some amazing wealth and passionate careers that matter.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, I'll tell you what, you inspired me to read the book again, that's for sure.
Oh, that's awesome. You got to get it on audiobook, because then you can play it anywhere, you know, at the gym, while you're driving.
Definitely, I'm going to do that.
So we are running out of time. I really want to thank you for being here. This has been an awesome experience, not only for myself, for Alexander. Alexander, your final thoughts on this?
There's definitely a lot of information I have to absorb and listen to over and over again. I really appreciate it. Thank you for coming on.
It was my pleasure, and it's great to meet you over the phone. And, you know, I'm a big fan of your mom, so anything she asks me to do, I'm always going to do everything I can to make it happen.
Appreciate it. I appreciate your time greatly, and I'll be looking for you on those Monopoly or Forbes top 500, 100.
Wait for some cool stuff. There's going to be some cool stuff coming around the horizon.
I love it. Creativity at its best.
If someone wants to get connected in Aurup or to you, where could they find you or in Aurup?
Well, they could go to the website, which is NAHREP.org. That's one way to find out more about the organization, and you can contact us directly through there, or they can reach me through my email, which is at gacosta, G-A-C-O-S-T-A, at NAHREP.org.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Gary. I know you're a busy man. I really appreciate it. Enjoy your evening with your family and don't work too hard. And thank you once again for introducing us to this awesome book.
I will. Thank you.
Awesome.
Nice job.
See you later.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Good night.